Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the morning of Wednesday, October 30th, 2019. My guest today is Rick Redding. Rick spent most of his career in senior leadership roles with the CME Group, including most recently as Managing Director for Products and Services. In this role, he led global sales, product development, and strategic global growth initiatives. He played an integral part in the transition of CME's ownership stake in Dow Jones Indexes to the S&P Dow Jones Indices joint venture. He also held senior positions in CME's Index Products division. Welcome to the show, Rick. It's a thrill to have you here.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So before we get into the meat of the conversation, which is really going to be about indexing, how things have really developed over time and what kind of trends you're seeing, because I think there's some really exciting things going on right now. And for listeners of a show like Let's Talk ETFs, what's happening in the index space really is kind of the main story in many ways of the ETF space, with such a high percent of assets being tied to funds that track indexes. But before we get into that, you spend a lot of time at the CME, where the name of the game is essentially options, futures, things that generally are associated with an active approach to investing. So I'm just curious, what drew you to head up the Index Industry Association, where passive investing reigns supreme?
Well, it's a great question. And I was a client of most of the index providers while I was at CME. So very familiar with them, very familiar with their space. And when they started this, it sounded like an interesting opportunity to come at it from the other side. And, you know, I've dealt with many of them for, 20 plus years, and thought it would be exciting to get their word out, because I don't think a lot of people think about the role that indexes play in the market. And even if people are not investing passively, the amount of indexes out there that are used for benchmarking purposes, which was the, kind of first use of indexes, it still reigns supreme. To put that in context, there's roughly 7,800, give or take, ETFs out there globally, and yet there's almost 3 million indexes. So that tells you the primary purpose for most of them is not for investment products, but it's actually for benchmarking purposes.
Yeah, sure. No, that's well put. And I think it is actually an important distinction that I'm sure we'll get into more shortly. So I think that many investors think about a few key headline indexes when they think of indexing, things like the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ 100, et cetera. How diverse is this space in actuality? The 3 million, how is that kind of split up? What different groupings of indexes, broadly speaking, would you say there are?
So you're absolutely right. Is, people can name probably a handful of them, quite honestly. And unless you're immersed in the industry, you probably can't name more than 100 indexes. But that's because so many of them are affiliated with equity products. And when you think about it, and the reason why there's so many is, take something like the S&P, for example. There'll be, S&P 500, there'll be, 11 sectors of the S&P 500. There'll be, approximately 40 industries that lie underneath that. When you think about, they may be calculated in five different currencies for different users all across the globe. You can see that the number gets very large very quickly. And the interesting thing in our survey is most of the listeners will probably think about the indexes they know in the U.S. But actually, from a percentage standpoint, the Americas are actually the smallest percentage of any in the world. I mean, you know, there's more in Asia Pacific or, you know, Europe or in the emerging markets than there are actually in the United States.
Sure. And is that a byproduct of the fact that there are just less companies listed in the U.S. and in the Americas than in, or not in the Americas, but in the U.S. than there are globally?
It just gets to the number of countries. When you think about it, there's an index for every country has their own index. And there's just so many countries in Europe or Asia that as you go through the sectors and the industries that, you know, expands exponentially. So, yeah, I think it's the number of countries that actually drives that.
Okay, interesting. And when we talk about this 3 million number of indexes, so are these almost all equity indexes? Or, I mean, I would assume they split in many different directions in terms of asset classes also.
Well, we capture the data in our survey, and we look at it primarily in three asset classes. We have an equity fixed income, and then we have an other bucket that captures everything else. You know, think about foreign exchange or real estate or hedge fund indexes, for example. There's all sorts of indexes out there. And you know, those numbers don't change that dramatically, the percentages. But equities is by far the largest of the categories.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So speaking of kind of interesting indexes, JP Morgan recently announced plans to launch a Vol-FEFI index, which measures market movements based on the president's tweets. I guess a play on his famous Covfefe index. And just curious if you had top of mind a couple of especially fun or quirky indices investors are unlikely to be familiar with.
Well, I mean, that's what is great about the index business. Because when you think about it, index is just a compilation of, you know, prices of securities, basically. So you've really seen a proliferation in the last few years of interesting areas where people have thought about capturing returns, really, from different segments. So, yeah, I mean, volatility is something that has, you know, been a big driver in the last few years. You see many more of these thematic indexes like you're referring to than you probably saw. I mean, unfortunately, the data set is only our third year of the survey, but I bet if you would have looked at it 5 or 10 years ago, we would have seen dramatic increase in the number of those themes because, you know, things change so quickly in markets and people are always trying to measure markets, you know, much more finely than they have in the past. So, yeah, I think you're always going to have a bunch of these novel indexes out there.
Yeah, sure. No, that makes sense. And investors will see some of them creeping into the ETF space over time. Also, some of the more exotic products that have been rolled out. But I imagine that many of them will remain just kind of theoretical or academic for most of their lives, or really always, just considering the number of indexes you mentioned relative to the number of funds that track indexes.
I think the data shows that out. We don't have data on assets under management, but for, you know, things I have seen out there in the industry, I mean, there's this large number of indexes out there, but it's still the large market cap weighted indexes that have the bulk of the assets from the data I've seen.
Yeah, sure. No, that's definitely the case. If you look at all the largest exchange traded funds and index mutual funds by AUM, they are of that plain vanilla variety. They're very, very large equity or fixed income indexes that the vast majority of those assets are tracking to. And I think we'll definitely have to get into the whole smart beta or factor investing trend, because I think it's obviously created a sea change in terms of the index space also. So it's something we'll have to come to in a bit. But before we do that, I would love to just kind of get into the history of indexing a little bit here. So, and particularly indexing as it pertains to investable vehicles, initially mutual funds. So the first index mutual fund was rolled out in late 1975, famously by Vanguard founder Jack Bogle, who passed away recently. And that was an S&P 500 tracking mutual fund. I think it kind of seemed like a real anomaly or exotic sort of product at the time that it was launched, because the idea of just accepting market returns and not trying to actively beat the market would have not been something that you pretty much anybody on Wall Street or Main Street would have entertained. You were investing to beat the market, not to accept market returns. But it appears at this point that after the reams of data that have been gathered about just how uncommon it is to actually beat these kind of standard, large, plain vanilla market cap weighted indexes over time. And, you know, so we've seen a real sea change in terms of both institutional investors and retail investors putting more and more of their eggs into these indexed baskets, so to speak. And that already started happening in the mutual fund space. But ETFs, exchange traded funds, have really been the spark that has led to the widespread proliferation of that trend. So currently, there's just over $4 trillion in U.S. domiciled ETFs, and over 98% of those assets are in index-based products. What is it about the exchange-traded fund structure specifically that you think has led to this sea change in terms of the adoption of indexing?
I think there's a number of factors that play into that. And, you know, obviously, cost is always one that investors look at. And I mean, it's just very efficient the way that the ETF trades, just like a stock on an exchange. And, you know, something that people don't think about a lot is, I mean, think about the innovation in the fixed income space, because you're taking fixed income products that have historically been over-the-counter products and putting them onto an exchange. So investors are getting the benefits of the regulatory structure that an exchange has and all of its oversight that it does there. So, you know, obviously there's, you know, tax benefits for it compared to other types of investing. So, yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, price, but also something that investors, I don't think about a lot on it, is when you're looking at an investment, an index or a rules-based ETF actually gives you the methodology of what they can invest in. So you know quite a bit about what you are getting. So compare it to buying into just a U.S. large cap growth fund. That could mean just about anything to a manager running one of those funds. And, you know, if that manager were to leave the next day, someone else may run it totally differently. Whereas in these rules-based ETFs, the indexes are run according to their methodology, and that's all transparent. So investors can see exactly what they're buying. And I think that has gone a long way of you know, making investors a lot more comfortable with what they're investing in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to imagine that what happened in 2008 and 2009 has really kind of accelerated this trend also, because you had these really large index, or not, sorry, actively managed mutual funds that were just loaded up on financials, on, you know, your Fannies and your Freddies and your Washington Mutuals. And because of the lack of transparency of actively managed mutual funds, you really had no idea what was in those products until it was too late in many cases. And so I think that, yeah, the transparency aspect, I think, does go a long way towards explaining it.
One thing I would, you know, that I would add that the IIA is very transparent about is, you know, the methodology is out there. It's up to you or your investment advisor to do the research, because the information's there. It's just we implore people to take the time to understand what the underlying benchmark or index is on the product, so you know how it will behave under all sorts of different situations. Because one of the things we see is a lot of times how the funds are marketed, they all sound like very similar products, but could react very differently based on economic conditions. Because as you said, you know, something that, you know, might be a high return kind of fund, maybe loaded up in financials, whereas another one may be loaded up in utilities. Those will react very differently as interest rates move up or down. So, I just implore people to understand that methodology and what the ETF and how it's being managed.
Yeah, sure. And the beauty of these products is that they are fully transparent and actually becoming more so. It used to just kind of be best practice that ETF issuers listed their holdings daily, but recently the SEC changed its requirements, and that's now obligatory at this point. So really degrees of transparency more than mutual funds, where you never know what they're holding in real time, because by the time they report, 60 days after the quarter ends, they could have a totally different portfolio by that point. That is a really important point that I think our listeners need to take home with them. Okay, so if you look at the board of the Index Industry Association, it's really a who's who of the world's top indexers: S&P Dow Jones, FTSE Russell, MSCI, CRSP, and so on. There's been a strong trend towards self-indexing in the ETF space, with a lot of issuers eschewing these kind of traditional major players in the indexing space and developing their own indexes and then products that track them. Do you view this as a positive development, a negative one, or some that has aspects of both the positive and the negative?
Yeah, there's pros and cons to looking at self-indexing. I mean, there's a couple of things that investors should think about before investing in. One is there some sort of conflict of interest in their index provider and the fund provider? You know, if you're an independent, all of our members are independent index providers, and that means they neither trade the underlying component securities, nor do they create the products for investors.
Sure. So in a word, none of them are broker-dealers, basically.
That's correct. Nor are they investment advisors.
Right.
That eliminates any potential conflict between those kind of three pieces of the value chain. One thing that you should always look at is, does the index provider have an interest in whether the index goes up or down? I mean, if you're independent, what you're trying to do is capture the best market representation for whatever segment you're trying to capture. You don't have a vested interest in whether the market goes up or down. You're looking for the best measure of it. Also in that is, make sure and look to see what kind of back testing was actually done on your index, if it's a newer index. You know, I think that's an area the SEC has been quite involved in recently, looking at to see how a lot of those back tests were done to make sure that there are, valid economic reasons for an index to do what they're doing. I mean, I think we all know of a famous story years ago that someone created an index with all the stocks with the letter C and claimed it could outperform all the major indexes. So there has to be some economic intuition of why you're investing in it. So it all kind of gets back to know what you're investing in and know why you're investing in it.
Yeah, sure. No, that's well put. And I guess, as you're saying, the fact that these indexers are independent means that they, they're self-auditing. They're not necessarily changing their methodologies every few years, which is something that can really skew longer-term results. And so you may save a few basis points when you self-index, but investor, if you're a retail investor and you're investing in that sort of a fund that's being self-indexed, but you may be losing something in terms of oversight and consistency, which is worth more than a few basis points in the long run. So
more and more investors are asking their fund manager, if they did create the index themselves, is it actually being administered by a third party? And I think that's an interesting trend we've seen since the kind of financial crisis, is people have started to ask, and you're starting to see kind of these partnership arrangements where even the ones that are self-indexing are kind of exporting that piece of it to a third-party provider, so that there is that extra level of protection.
Oh, so that's good. Okay, yeah. So I guess definitely, I think, bears mentioning for listeners that it is worth looking into that to understand whether there may be some inherent underlying conflict of interest there, or even if somebody is, if an asset manager is self-indexing, if there is still that proper oversight in place. Because if there isn't, then you don't really have the ability to rest easy in terms of how that index is being administered and rebalanced and reconstituted over time. So definitely something for people to keep an eye on. So you've already referenced this several times, but you recently released the Index Industry Association's third annual survey, which I think is a great stepping off point to discuss unfolding trends in indexing. What were the big take-home points?
Well, yes, this is our third annual. And the reason why we did it was people within the industry had no idea how many indexes were out there. And, basically all the index providers knew what they calculated, but really had no idea what else was out there. And what we found was there's a lot of indexes being used for benchmarking, a lot of custom benchmarks that, people just didn't have any knowledge of. And so we did it as an educational piece, but it's been interesting because in our third year, we've seen some trends develop in the industry. In the last 2 years, we've seen fixed income indexes grow quite nicely. And also in the area of ESG, it's really taken off in the last couple of years. And I think those are, very important trends and something that, who knows what the future has, but I mean, with so many people talking about, more socially responsible investing, I think the ESG area is one that's ripe and one where I see a lot of our members doing a lot of research and development in.
Yeah, sure. And still really in its very early stages, if you look at the types of products that or indexes that could be developed in that space, there's still kind of a pretty limited scope to it. I did notice that the number of indexes fell by about 700,000. What do you make of that exactly? What is that? First of all, what does that mean? I don't even know how to really think about that kind of scale in terms of index numbers. But it looked like a year ago survey, there was like 3.7 million and there's just under 3 million indexes now. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, it's actually hard for me to see through the data the way I get it to know exactly what that means. But it appears to me, and what I've seen in all the years of that we've been doing this, is there's a lot of movement within the component pieces. And, every year the index providers look out and, to see what they calculate or administer and say, are there duplicative indexes? I mean, if we created, extra indexes that just it's more noise in the market than it is clarity. And, every year they come in and, obviously create a whole bunch of new ones, but they also take a whole bunch out. So I think that's actually healthy for the market because it keeps, costs down because, as you mentioned earlier, cost is a big issue in the industry. So I think it's a natural, healthy process that's going on.
Yeah, sure. No, that makes sense. And where is smart beta or factor investing on this list? I didn't see it mentioned in the press release or the summary of the survey. Just I know that was kind of huge in terms of the number of indexes being generated just a few years ago. So perhaps that explains the precipitous fall in the numbers. Maybe people are pulling some of those back.
Well, I mean, I think, kind of the point you were making earlier is people start a lot of these indexes or, smart beta or thematic ones, and, they just don't have traction to them. So, that might be an area. I mean, I don't know exactly, where a lot of those indexes came from. But, I mean, I think that's a realistic place to think about. Not everything that is created works. And, not everything that's created, has a natural client base for it. So, as I said, I think it's naturally a good thing that they go back and clean it up if there's no reason for it.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. And to maybe wade into the active passive debate here. So I think there's a bit of a misnomer that indexing by definition means passive, whereas active management by definition means hyperactive in some way. How do you respond when you hear these kinds of oversimplified binary definitions of indexing, passive, active investing, very active?
I love that question because I have difficulties with categorizing things as active or passive, because even if you use a passive investment, there is some active element to it of why you're investing in it at that time. You asked me about my career at CME, that's, is obviously much more active trading. There's also, it's a component of active trading in passive investing, because you have to make an asset allocation decision and also a timing decision on when you're going to move into those products. So I think it's also, as the ETF world has expanded, become a lot more confusing, because some of the products that are not traditionally market cap weighting may actually have pretty high turnover in them. So a lot of those products are starting to look more like active products, as the way we've defined it. And I almost think the right way to think about it is to think about kind of active products and then rules-based products, whether it's a market cap-based index or it's even a smart beta type product, is know that there's rules behind the index and how the methodology works. And that may be a more natural way to start thinking about this than active or passive.
Yeah, sure. And I believe that Morningstar recently actually has revisited the way that they measure different categories for their fund ratings, and that they have now split up indexing into just fully, very passive, kind of plain vanilla, and then more active indexing, which, again, despite being rules-based, really they are more akin to, many actively managed funds, in that they're way more reactive to things in the market, and they're, they have higher levels of turnover. And I guess, depending on the asset class or the strategy, that could actually be a winning proposition. So, people in the industry are starting to take note of this, I think, in meaningful ways.
I applaud that thinking that, people, again, it gets back down to people need to understand what the turnover in the portfolio looks like. It's all part of the due diligence process. And, I think you mentioned it earlier, is the ETF wrapper around these indexes or around these products too. I mean, really has made it a lot more convenient for investors to use those indexes or, that smart beta type index because of the ETF wrapper. And I think a lot of the active managers now are into the ETF space because they want that kind of distribution and the use of that. It's a really powerful tool for investors. So I think this just continues.
Yeah, no, I don't see it slowing down as a trend anytime soon. So one concern that you hear as the percent of assets that is tied to indexes, and again, these can be more active or more passive. I think the underlying part of the concern that kind of is, goes across indexes is that these are rules-based strategies, is that the way that stock markets, the price discovery mechanism is based on the fact that you have different people buying and selling at any given time. The market is a weighing machine, right? And that through that, you end up with some level of efficiency in pricing of different assets. And that as the percent of assets tied to rules-based indexing climbs, you're going to end up with price disconnects, because you're going to end up with people buying the good with the bad based on rules and not based on, millions of different individuals doing their due diligence. Is this, and I'm not saying that we're going to get to this point anytime soon of price discovery becoming muted in some way, but do you find this to be a reasonable longer term concern in any way?
I think you said it right. I think we're so far away from that point. I think it's mostly a theoretical argument right now. I think some of the studies that are well done show you know, passive investing roughly in the 20% or so of the world. When you look, you know, across the different vehicles, you know, not just looking specifically at mutual funds, for example, but looking at the entire landscape of investments. And I think we're so far away from that. I think people are worrying about a lot of things that will probably never come out. I mean, there's some academic literature out there at the University of Chicago says until that, you know, gets north of 75-85%, you'll always have active managers setting the prices. And I think the thing that people don't understand is they're looking at assets under management and not necessarily the trading of the product. So when you think about an index product, a lot of that trading all just takes place at the close. So even if the assets under management become a high percentage, that's not actually talking about the percentage of the trading volumes. So there will always be active players out there who are, you know, trading intraday, really the ones setting the prices. So it's not like you see the index funds trading, you know, five times a day, even. Most of the times you see them just trading at the close.
Yeah, sure. No, that's well put. And the data that I've seen, yeah, is that number of assets tied to indexing or index products is maybe around 20 or 21% at this point. But that if you look at actual trading numbers, it's south of 10%, the amount of trades that actually take place tied to indexing in some way. So yeah, it is something that you hear. And I guess there's some theoretical argument to be had there, but it seems like, you know, worrying about whether, you know, we'll run out of water on Mars in 2100 or something. So yeah, no, I hear that. I think that's it's well put on your part. So one other question that that's been bugging me a bit lately before we get into kind of what you guys have planned coming up and where people can find you online. There's just been a, let's say, 20-something year bear market in the number of companies that are publicly listed in the U.S. So in 1996, you had a peak of more than 8,000 companies publicly listed on the major U.S. exchanges. At that time, there were three: the New York Stock Exchange, the American Stock Exchange, and the NASDAQ. And at this point, that number is just under 4,400 companies. So the Wilshire 5000 hasn't actually had 5,000 companies in it for more than a decade at this point. Do you view this as a longer-term headwind for the indexing industry? Is it important for there to be a large, diverse number of underlying securities to be indexed for this to remain viable in some way?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fundamental difference in how capital markets work today than they did, 20 years ago. I mean, I think there's a lot of money out there in the private equity world or a lot of money out there in the venture world. So companies actually have alternatives to fundraising rather than going public.
Right. I mean, within reason, obviously, companies that are the size of Uber or Lyft, they're not going to get their $50 billion they need in private markets. But anybody that's, you know, mid-cap or smaller really does not need to go the listing.
Right. And your question's a good one because, I mean, you cited the U.S., but IIA is a global organization. I travel quite a bit. I think if you look at Europe, they've had very few IPOs in the last few years. I mean, I think it's a bigger issue there than it is even in the United States. So, I think if you look at it globally, it's a much bigger issue. But on the other hand, you see a lot of companies going public in Asia. So I think a lot of it just has to depend on capital market structure and within a region, also listing requirements on exchanges. So, you know, it's just a different world now than it was back then. So, you know, I think bottom line is what you tend to see is when companies come to market, they tend to be much more developed now, much larger float or much larger, you know, capitalization, sorry, when they actually do go public. So, you know, the idea of this really small micro cap going public now, it just seems like the ones you hear about now are the really big ones that have gone through the venture, gone through the private equity stages. And by the time they actually do an IPO, they're just much bigger, more established companies.
Yeah, sure. No, that makes sense. And the truth is, you mentioned Asia, and globally, the number of listings has maybe flattened out over the last few years, but it's continued to go up over the last last 23 years or so. I mean, you know, the number of companies listed in a place like China today versus 20 years ago is factor of probably 20 or something. So, yeah, so globally, that is still there. And I guess as the major indexers are able to integrate more companies in listed in different places into their products, the more you have that additional kind of diversification. So, for example, MSCI has been integrating companies that are listed on the China A-shares market over the last few years. So that definitely brings a bunch of additional companies into that investable indexing fold that weren't there previously. So I guess maybe perhaps the bigger picture is that maybe in super developed places like Western Europe and the U.S., you have seen that kind of bottoming out or the unwinding of a company's listing, but it just maybe means that indexes look a lot more globally diversified than they used to some extent.
Well, I think that's a general trend in kind of just the globalization of markets over the last couple of decades is, it is getting more difficult even for an index provider to figure out where to put a company in an index geographically because, you know, a company may be headquartered in one place, but the majority of the revenues, you know, made halfway across the world. So, a reason why to understand the methodology and it to see how each index treats that. And, you know, your example is, you know, look at the methodology, see how, you know, each, you know, provider thinks about what's an emerging economy, what's a developed economy, because they'll have very different looking indexes and have very different return patterns. So again, I get back to that point of do your due diligence to understand the methodology.
Yeah, sure. No, that's a great point. Yeah, I spoke to Stephen Schoenfeld of Blue Star Indexes a couple months back, and I found the way that they are indexing countries very interesting at this point. They really are not looking at listing, which exchange companies being listed are domiciled in. They really are just looking at economic exposure, and it's a very different approach, and certainly I think one that's welcome in the space. And I know other companies are doing that. You know, companies as large as iShares are doing that. So, you know, their Argentina index doesn't hold that many companies actually listed in Buenos Aires. It lists it includes companies that just offer exposure to the Argentinian economy and markets.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair point. In the institutional investing space, you tend to see institutional investors take an approach and be consistent with it so they don't inadvertently pick up stocks that are included in different parts of the world or in different indexes based on choosing one index from one provider and one index for another provider, because sometimes you take unintended risk and you don't even realize it.
Yeah, sure. No, that definitely makes sense. So what does the Index Industry Association have planned in 2020?
A lot of education. We were primarily set up to do education, and then a lot of regulation and regulatory work was starting to happen in Europe in particular after the IBOR crisis. So, you know, we do deal in that. But we've just relaunched our website, and, you know, we've provided a bunch of educational videos out there, you know, on topics like ESG or topics, you know, why an independent index provider provides you more security, or just a whole host of topics. And there's a number of videos, white papers out there. So, you know, what do indexes and what do benchmarks do for capital markets? I mean, you know, people don't even necessarily realize how almost everyone is somehow tied to an index, even with their pension plan, or whether they know it or not, they're using an index. So, if people are interested, look at our website. There's a lot of good educational material out there.
Yeah, sure. For people that want to do that, what is that?
It is indexindustry.org.
Excellent. And the white paper section, if you had to, let's say, recommend one paper for people that are just starting out here, what would you recommend?
I would go to the insights section, and you can see the different kind of topics. And there's, you know, we've created some videos and tried to keep them short for people to, you know, get to the crux of the matter pretty quickly and then delve in as deeply as they want. But that would be the first place I would send them to is the insights piece.
Okay, sure. That's great. And final question, are you guys on social media? Can people follow you there?
Yes, we are active tweeting, and we also do some things on LinkedIn.
All right. Excellent. That's great. Anyway, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time today, Rick. I think this has been really educational. I think we've covered a lot of different components of the indexing space, and particularly how they tie into exchange-traded funds and the explosive growth that that particular investing vehicle has seen over the last 20 years. I want to wish you best of luck in 2020 and keep on doing the good work that you guys are doing.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the chance to talk to your audience, because, you know, so many of the product providers do so much advertising, and, you know, a lot of it's all on fees. There's a whole level beneath that I think investors should think about, and that's think about what the underlying index is on what they're investing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we've spoken to a couple of index providers already on this show, and my plan is to keep on talking to index providers, because, as you said, I don't think most investors, even more advanced ones, realize just how central indexes are to the entire asset management space and the entire endeavor of investing.
And that's why we were created. So again, thank you for the time.
Yep, thank you.
For disclosures, neither myself nor Rick Redding have positions in anything mentioned in today's show.
If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on SeekingAlpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.